So sometimes we call our stuff the visible sector. And we assume the supersymmetry breaking occurs in some hidden sector. And a big part of the motivation for this is this supertrace relation that says roughly the sum of particles in the superpartners weighted by the fermion number has to go to zero. So we want to hide supersymmetry breaking in a sense. So the picture here is we have supersymmetry breaking. We parameterize it by some non-zero F term. This is our order parameter for supersymmetry breaking. There's some messenger sector that connects the supersymmetry breaking to the MSSM. And these messengers have some fairly large mass, M star, and some effective coupling between these two. And what you get out at the end of the day, after you integrate out the heavy messenger dynamics and the heavy hidden dynamics, are soft terms in the visible sector on the order of C star F over M star. So this is the generic cartoon. And let me give you a few explicit examples. The first example is called gravity mediation. And gravity mediation, it's not actually all that gravitational, but if you recall from our earlier discussion that a very naive expectation for a theory of quantum gravity is that there exist new states with mass close to M Planck and order one couplings to us. So in this case, if you have some hidden sector, they get some non-zero F term Vev. This hidden sector, because gravity couples universally, we expect that quantum gravity stuff will connect the hidden sector to our sector, at least through some states of mass M Planck. And with an order one coupling, and that just gives you that tells you that M soft in this kind of naive supergravity picture motivated story is going to be just F over M Planck. Where to do better than this, you have to really specify some sort of attempt at a quantum theory of gravity. So this gravity mediation story is instead of a concrete model for supersymmetry breaking, it's more of a, let's say, a paradigm. And in general, you don't have much control over what the actual specific soft masses are. Now, having said that, there's a popular simplifying choice that's largely motivated by convenience more than any kind of theoretical motivation. But I should mention it because it comes up a lot in literature, and sometimes it's called M-SUGRA, which stands for minimal supergravity. It's not even necessarily related to supergravity so much, but it's just an assumption that you start off at some scale. I'll call it input. And kind of the traditional assumption, mostly for historical reasons, is it's on the order of the gut scale, which is roughly 10 to the minus 2 times the Planck scale. And the assumption for M-SUGRA, and again, this is largely just an assumption, and it's largely made for convenience, is that the scalar soft masses at the input scale are all given by some universal value set by some number M0. So by scalar soft masses, I mean the M squared phi squared pieces in the soft Lagrangian. The second thing is they assume that the Gugino soft masses are all given by MA is equal to some universal thing called M1/2. And remember that the form of the Gugino soft mass was like that. And finally, you assume you have non-trivial A terms that are given by AI is just, again, some universal thing. Where, if you recall, the form of the A terms is Y A phi cubed, where Y is the corresponding superpotential Yukawa coupling. So this is just an assumption. And it's an assumption made specifically at this input scale. And what you do is, or what's done in practice is, let's say this is my this is my energy. So this is my, I'll call the scale Q. At my input scale, I fix universal values for all these things. And then I extrapolate them down to low energies. And by low energies, I mean near the weak scale, let's say near MZ, by the renormalization group stuff. So for example, for the Gugino soft masses, I start them all at the same place, but they run differently. These things all run differently going to low energies. So I'm running out of space here. But as you run them down, you get different M1, M2, and M3, the Gluino, Wino, and Beano soft masses. And the approximate story for these is that for each of the gauge groups, or for any of the gauge groups, the Gugino soft mass relative to the gauge coupling squared is roughly constant. So if I think about extrapolating the gauge couplings down from high energy, where this picture is also motivated by unification, where in minimal supersymmetry, all the gauge couplings start at the same value. If I extrapolate everything down, the strong coupling gets stronger, going to low energies. The SU2 coupling stays basically flat, and the U1 coupling decreases. And the upshot of this is that if I look at the effective soft masses near MZ, the ratio ends up coming out to a fairly characteristic ratio of 6 to 2 to 1. And again, this is just from the renormalization effect. So this is the low energy value. They all start off at the same value by assumption in the setup, and they're split by the renormalization group running. Now, the story for the scalar soft masses is a little bit different, but one general feature is that the scalar soft masses that are charged under SU3 color, those tend to get larger. And that means that in this minimal setup, you get heavier squarks relative to sleptons. The other thing it gives, though, is that on the one hand, as you run these down to lower energies, the strong coupling tends to pull them up, whereas Yukawa couplings tend to pull them down. Now, the only Yukawa coupling that's really relevant for this is the top Yukawa coupling. And the top Yukawa coupling affects the scalar top superpartner soft masses and the Higgs soft masses. And what can happen is, suppose I start all the scalar soft masses at some common M0. Maybe I'll get some colorful chalk for this. What happens for the first generation? So the first two generations tend to get pulled up by gauge effects, at least for the squarks. But in contrast to that, the stuff with strong Yukawa couplings can sometimes run flat or run small. And one thing that can happen in particular is that even if I start out at a positive value, I could run to a negative value for MH up squared. And this is kind of a neat feature. You're still making an assumption, but it's kind of a neat feature in that even if you start all of these masses at the same point, the scalar soft mass corresponding to H up squared tends to run negative. And this is the thing that helps you drive electric symmetry breaking. So there is a nice story of how electric symmetry breaking happens. Sometimes this is called radiative electric symmetry breaking, in that your effective Higgs mass parameter in the high energy theory is positive, but through the effects of renormalization group running, it gets pulled negative. So the this helps you. This is precisely what you want to get electric symmetry breaking, and it happens very naturally, even if I start everything at the same value because of the large top Yukawa coupling. Okay, so this is gravity mediation. So let me emphasize that gravity mediation, most generally, is just this relation. And you can't say much more without a specific theory. This M supra story is just a convenient assumption. It's convenient because instead of having sort of something like 80 different soft terms, it gives you effectively three numbers. And just as in terms of writing papers or comparing with experiments and so on, it's much easier to deal with three numbers than 80. And I'm semi-serious about this. I mean, this is a good simple model to look at, but part of the appeal I also have to admit is just that it's very simple. So this is gravity mediation. The second mechanism I want to mention is called gauge mediation. And what happens in gauge mediation is you have messengers that couple to a hidden sector, but the messengers carry standard model gauge charges. And what you get out for MSoft generically and is essentially g squared over 4 pi squared f over m star, where m star is the mass of the messengers. So this is a schematic relation. Here, g is a gauge coupling of a gauge group that couples to the corresponding superpartner. And so this is a generic relation. For this effect to dominate over gravity mediation, we see that it comes in with a loop factor instead of an order one factor. And that means that this only works if your messenger scale is relatively low, at least relatively low by loop factor compared to the Planck scale. So gauge mediation is nice in that it's, in some sense, it's more calculable in that it doesn't depend on your underlying theory of quantum gravity. A very simple theory of gauge mediation has messengers that I'm going to call Q. And these transform as a 5 plus 5 bar. So these transform as a 5 and 5 bar of SU5, which means they have components charged under all the gauge groups of the standard model. And what ends up happening is this X is the source of supersymmetry breaking. And we also assume that there's a mass term for these messengers. And you can show that if this X piece that has a superpotential coupling like this gets an F term BEV, what it does is it splits the scalar components of the scalar components of these Q and QC chiral superfields by an amount. It splits their mass by an amount on the order of lambda x. So in other words, after supersymmetry breaking, what I get is for the fermion parts of these, I get a mass m star. And for the scalar parts, I get masses that are given by m squared plus or minus f x. So the assumption is that this x field gets an f term bev. And if you compute the masses in this theory with spontaneous breaking from x, what you find is the fermion masses are unsplit, but the scalar masses or mass squareds are split by f. So the upshot of all this is I take this and I can look at integrating out the heavy stuff and the effect that has on the visible sector. So one thing I can look at is a loop of a standard model gauge boson. So for example, let's do the standard model Gluino. So this is a fermion. So it's a fermion line, and I'm drawing squiggles to denote that it's a gaugino. This state is going to have a coupling to the fermion and superpartner from Q. And this loop, you'll have this coupling. There will also be a coupling with So let's see, you have this, and what are the other diagrams? The other diagrams are, is this going to cancel against something? Just a second. What's my other diagram? So at the level of superfields, you can write this like this. This is the whole story. So from this diagram, you find that you get, for example, for the Galeno mass, something that goes like G3 squared over 4 pi squared fx over m star. So this loop generates an effective Galeno mass from this, and it comes about specifically because you have a mass splitting between here and here. There's also a correction to the scalar masses. So for example, I could look at let's say a squark. And the correction to the squark comes at two loops. The squark loop correction has this form where this is a QC in the loop, and this is the gauge boson. So let's say just a regular gluon, or it could be other stuff. And this contribution at two loops, if I count the number of couplings, this contribution turns out to it has four couplings and it's two loop. So you get a factor that looks like G3 squared over 4 pi squared all squared times F x over m star squared. And the upshot of this is the two loop diagrams that contribute to the scalars, if I take their square root, they're the same size as the one loop diagrams that contribute to the gaugeinos. So I've only sketched the calculation, but in principle, if you take this theory, work out all the mass eigenstates, compute these loops, and match this theory of spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, integrating out the messengers at scale m star, this tells me what my soft masses are at that m star scale in the effective theory where I've integrated out the messengers. So I can think of these corrections as physical finite threshold corrections obtained from integrating out the heavy messengers. And in terms of the low energy effective theory, just like I said before, my original theory is supersymmetric, but it has spontaneous supersymmetry breaking in the form of an F term bev for X. And this translates into a low energy theory where it looks like I have explicit supersymmetry breaking. Yes? Yes, so that can come in as well. You need F terms because if you don't have F terms, you can show that you never get gaugeino masses. And actually, one way to see that is either on a tutorial or one of the homeworks where I spoke about U1R symmetries. There exists a U1R symmetry for the MSSM at the supersymmetric level. The supersymmetry breaking breaks explicitly through things like gaugeino masses. But it turns out the scalar soft masses don't break it explicitly. And so it turns out to generate gaugeino masses, I also need a source of R breaking. And I don't get a source of R breaking if I only have D terms because the D terms have zero charge under the UNR. So I do need F terms, and the standard assumption is that you're dominated by F terms. There is one twist where you get gaugeino masses in a different way, where instead of just having a Majorana mass for one gaugeino, you could instead generate something that looks like a Dirac mass where you couple a gaugeino to some other state. And in that case, you can be dominated by what looks like D-term breaking. Okay, so I have gravity mediation, I have gauge mediation, and I want to mention one more mechanism. And the third mechanism I want to mention is called anomaly mediation. And anomaly mediation is, in fact, more accurately gravity mediation than what we call gravity mediation. In the sense that gravity mediation doesn't actually reference anything specifically having to do with gravity other than our expectation of heavy states associated with quantum gravity with masses near M Planck. What anomaly mediation does is here the multiplet that actually contains a graviton and also contains a gravitino, and I'll actually get to this in a little bit. This multiplet is actually responsible in this case for transferring supersymmetry breaking from the hidden sector to the visible sector. So first of all, this is a fairly subtle effect, so I'm just going to quote the result. It wasn't found until relatively recently. And the other thing is that relative to naive gravity mediation, it's suppressed. So what I mean by this is that for anomaly mediation, it's an actual, if you like, gravitational multiplet doing the mediation. And here, your soft mass in all the sectors gets a loop factor that's analogous to gauge mediation, but comes in with an F over M Planck. So because gravity couples universally to everything, and we're supersymmetrizing the theory to have a supersymmetric extension of gravity, these anomaly mediated contributions are always there no matter what, as long as gravity is ultimately supersymmetrized. Now, if I compare to gravity mediation, the regular gravity mediation, this is down by a loop factor. So this contribution So this anomaly mediated contribution is only relevant if, for one reason or another, the naive gravity mediated piece is suppressed in some way. And this suppression of the regular gravity mediated piece is fairly non-trivial and is sometimes called sequestering. And kind of a general cartoon for sequestering, and we'll actually come back to this when I talk about extra dimensions, is that one way to get the sequestering, in a sense, is to have, let's say, our MSSM over here on one localized on one so-called brain in an extra dimension. So this is an extra dimension. And let's put supersymmetry breaking over here. And if this extra dimension is in some sense large relative to the Planck scale, and by large I mean that the radius should be larger than 1 over M Planck, it turns out that the direct communication of supersymmetry breaking through the gravity-mediated stuff can be suppressed over here. And the leading thing that's going to communicate with them is gravity. And by gravity, I mean the actual gravity multiplet. And in this case, anomaly mediation can win out. So actually getting this to work is pretty hard, but there are some string-motivated realizations for it. You can actually do something similar in terms of sequestering involving new strong dynamics, and I'll also touch on that a bit later on as well. But in any case, these anomaly-mediated pieces are, well, they're universal in the sense that they're essentially always there, but they're not always important. Yeah, so there's also some argument as to whether there's an actual anomaly. So part of the so-called anomaly has to do with the fact that, I'll talk about this in, well, I won't talk about this, but to write down a theory of gravity that's supersymmetric, it gets really complicated really quickly. And it turns out that one thing that would make your life easier is if you had additional symmetries. And one set of additional symmetries is something called a conformal symmetry. So conformal symmetry means an invariance under scale transformations. And I'll talk a bit about conformal symmetries down the road as well. But the story here is that you start with a theory with supersymmetry, conformal symmetry, and gravity. And it turns out that this big combined theory is easier to deal with than without conformal symmetry. But at the same time, the conformal symmetry, you don't actually want it there, because conformal symmetry means that there's no fixed scale, but we know that there's a fixed scale having to do with gravity, which is the Planck scale. So the idea is you start with a theory that is basically, that's essentially conformal and supersymmetric. You use that to build your supersymmetric theory of gravity, but then you go in and you essentially turn on something that looks like a VEV that breaks the conformal part. And that breaking the conformal part is sometimes related to saying there's an anomaly related to the conformal transformations. It's not really an anomaly in that it wasn't really symmetry in the first place, but you have the idea. So the name anomaly mediation is somewhat historical. Maybe a better name would be something like gravity supermultiplet mediation. But in any case, we have these three different mediation mechanisms, and there are lots of variations. There are lots of variations that combine one or the other, and they all have their, let's say, strengths and weaknesses. So it turns out that gravity mediation, because in general, you don't have much control over what the soft masses actually are, they can be a problem in that they can give you soft masses that give you too much flavor mixing. For gauge mediation, it can be a little bit non-trivial to get theories that actually work when you try to make everything work. With anomaly mediation, it turns out that some of the soft masses, at least if you do anomaly mediation in a minimal sense, some of the soft masses for the sleptons end up running negative. And a negative slepton soft mass would mean that some of the sleptons would get VEVs. And if sleptons get VEVs, you spontaneously break electromagnetism, and this is ruled out. So these mechanisms all have their pluses and minuses. There are combinations of them that can work and that are viable, but it's not obvious that one is correct and another isn't. One other thing I'd like to get to next, after talking about the mediation mechanisms, is going back and thinking about how the actual spontaneous supersymmetry breaking itself occurs. So we've kind of swept this under the rug by pushing it off into a hidden sector, but it's still something to worry about because you will have seen in some explicit examples that when you break supersymmetry spontaneously, you get a massless fermion mode called a Goldsteinow. So the Goldsteinow is just like your standard Nambu-Goldstone boson, but now because we're looking at a symmetry that's generated by fermionic generators, instead of having a massless boson, you have a massless fermion called a Goldsteinow. So and actually, in the last tutorial, I think you actually showed that if there is spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, you can show there's a zero in the fermion mass matrix, just as an automatic consequence in a very general way. So this spontaneous supersymmetry breaking implies that there exists a massless Goldsteinow. So this is a spin 1/2 fermion. And with a bit more work, you can show that the massless Goldsteinow, so I'll just call it psi, couples to the MSSM, or everything else for that matter, so the strength of the coupling of the Goldsteinow to other stuff involves a higher dimensional operator suppressed by 1 over f, where f is the amount of supersymmetry breaking. And again, this, if you compare this with regular Goldstone bosons, is also fairly similar to what happens there. OK, so this would actually be a problem phenomenologically if there's a new massless state around. So a new massless state around it can be troublesome for cosmology. So for example, it would act as a new relativistic degree of freedom in the early universe. And these can cause trouble. And it also has some non-trivial coupling to the standard model, and you might have expected that we could have produced it already. So in a way, we don't want to have a new massless state, but it turns out that we don't actually have a massless state when we couple this theory to gravity. So just as we did before, let's extend our MSSM to include gravity, at least gravity as you can interpret it as an effective field theory. So in the standard model, we just took the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian and coupled it to Lagrangian for the standard model and expanded around flat space fluctuations. And this gave us spin two gravitons. What we have to do now is, let's say we expand around flat space or some other fixed background. We can identify in that case a spin two graviton, but we need to embed that state within a supermultiplet to preserve supersymmetry. And the supersymmetric part implies that I'll write it this way. Our spin two graviton has a spin 3/2 superpartner called the gravitino. And in fact, this extension is more complicated than just adding a new supermultiplet. We actually get a whole new structure called supergravity. And just as an aside, you may or may not have heard this before, but there is a sense in which you can think of regular general relativity, regular Einstein gravity, as a gauging of local coordinate transformations. I should say more specifically, a gauging of Poincaré. So if you take Poincaré transformations and you extend them to local transformations, and these local transformations correspond to local coordinate transformations, and you demand invariance under that, and you make some reasonable assumptions, you get out general relativity. So there's a sense in which general relativity is a gauging of Poincaré. And here we've extended Poincaré to a super Poincaré, to a supersymmetry plus Poincaré. And if we think of gauging that, and if we think of extending that to local transformations, a subset of which will be local coordinate transformations, we get what's called supergravity. And going from global supersymmetry to supergravity is completely analogous to going from Poincaré to general relativity. It just ends up being somewhat more complicated. But one of the things you get out of this as an automatic consequence is, in general relativity, you can think of the graviton as being like the gauge boson for local coordinate transformation variance. Now we get a whole supermultiplet corresponding to this invariance under if you like local supersymmetry transformations. And we get our theory of supergravity. And again, there's a whole lot. Okay, again, supergravity is multiple courses on its own, so I'm not going to get too deeply into it. But there is an important consequence. If I take local supersymmetry in the form of supergravity, and I put in a spontaneous breaking. So if you think about gauge theories, if I start with a global symmetry, and I spontaneously break a local. So if I spontaneously break a continuous global symmetry, I get a massless Goldstone. On the other hand, if I take that global symmetry and reinterpret it as a gauge invariance, this local, now when I spontaneously break that, I don't have a massless Goldstone, but instead that massless Goldstone is eaten by the vector boson to make a massive vector. And it turns out that in local supersymmetry and supergravity, the same thing happens when you spontaneously break supersymmetry. What happens in this case is you go from, you would have a massless spin two graviton and a massless spin 3 halves Gravitino. It's not quite spin 3 halves because it's massless. And it turns out that a massless spin 3 half Gravitino has two degrees of freedom if it's massless. In fact, any massless particle you can show that has effectively two degrees of freedom. So a photon has two polarization states, even though sometimes we call it spin 1. A vial fermion and its antiparticle has particle antiparticle states at 2 degrees of freedom. You have something similar here for the Gravitino. Even though it's nominally spin 3 halves, if it's massless, it actually has 2 physical degrees of freedom. Now, what happens when you spontaneously break supersymmetry is we would have a massless Goldsteino, but it turns out that this massless Goldsteino is eaten by the Gravitino, and the Gravitino gets a mass. So if I take supersymmetry breaking and supergravity, what ends up happening is my would-be massless Goldsteino is eaten by the Gravitino. And what you get from this is you get a massive Gravitino. And you can count the degrees of freedom. So in the unbroken theory, initially you would think of having 2 degrees of freedom for the massless Gravitino and 2 degrees of freedom for the massless would be Goldsteino. But these combine to give a single massive Gravitino, which has 4 degrees of freedom. So now, instead of having a massless massless Gravitino and a massless Goldsteino, what ends up happening in this gauging sense, in a way that's completely analogous to what happens in gauge theories when you spontaneously break them, is now my would-be massless Goldstone mode is eaten to make a massive, in this case, Gravitino. And you can show very generally that the Gravitino mass, and I'll push this up so everybody can see, very generally, the Gravitino mass, which we usually write as m3 halves, is roughly F over root 3 M Planck, assuming that the spontaneous breaking of supersymmetry is parameterized by a single F term. If you have multiple F terms or also D terms, they can also contribute to this. But for now, let's just focus on a single F term. So now we have our Gravitino mass. This is good in that we have a massless state instead of a massless state. And this is typically better in terms of cosmology. But we can also look at the mass of the Gravitino relative to the masses of the standard model superpartners. And relative to the standard model superpartners, if you look at gravity mediation, the Gravitino mass is about the same size as the standard model superpartners. If you look at gauge mediation wants that this combination ends up being bigger than F over M Planck. So that it dominates over gravity mediation. So if gauge mediation dominates, that means that my Gravitino mass is much less than the superpartner masses. And finally, in anomaly mediation, my soft masses are down by a loop factor from F over M Planck. And that means that in anomaly mediation, my soft masses, my standard model superpartners are lighter than the Gravitino. So just to summarize, the general thing that happens is M soft is about the same size as the Gravitino mass. And this mass hierarchy has important observational consequences. And I'll get to them in just a second. But one more thing I'd like to write down are the effective couplings of the gravitino to regular stuff. And I have these written down more nicely in my notes, but roughly, the form of the couplings of the massive gravitino to standard model matter, there's an effective coupling 1 over M Planck to a fermion gamma mu gamma nu g tilde nu. And there's an effective coupling to the vector bosons. Okay, so these actual couplings are a bit complicated, but let me just point out a few important features. First of all, the coupling of the gravitino always connects to a standard model state and its superpartners. And this coupling also always involves a derivative somewhere. And third of all, there's always a suppression by M Planck. So these are the three main features. You have gravitino, standard model, superpartner. There's a derivative and a suppression by M Planck. And you see the same thing here. I've got my gravitino. I've got a standard model state, in this case, a vector boson. And this is its superpartner, the corresponding gaugino. And there's a derivative in this field string. And you can show that the part that the gravitino is coupling to corresponds to something that looks like the derivative of the conserved supercurrent. So if you find the node current corresponding to supersymmetry Hund transformations and take its derivative, that's roughly what you get here. So the 1 over M Planck isn't too surprising because this picture is coming out of supergravity. And ultimately, they're gravitational interactions. But it turns out that in a certain limit, the effective coupling can actually be much larger than what it looks like here. And the way to see this is that the massive gravitino has, if you like, transverse and longitudinal polarizations. And it turns out that the longitudinal polarizations get an effectively enhanced coupling at large energies. And at large energies, it turns out that at high energies, and by high energies I mean large compared to N3/2, the gravitino coupling essentially reduces to primarily the longitudinal mode, which you can identify as the massless would-be Goldsteino. And if you recall over here, the massless Goldsteino couples to the MSSM with strength 1 over F. And in general, 1 over F is big compared to the M Planck. And the enhancement that ends up coming about to give you a 1 over F has to do with the longitudinal polarizations of that. Have you seen the Goldstone boson equivalence principle in the standard model course? No. Okay, so maybe I'll say something about that quickly, but just as a moral of the story, for these interactions, it turns out that for E much, much greater than N3/2, you can make the replacement of G tilde mu goes to √2/3 del mu psi over M3/2. And this effective replacement, if I put in an M3/2 here, for example, instead of over here, what I would get is something that looks like M3/2 times M Planck. But M3/2 times M Planck gives me a 1 over F. And in general, these 1 over F couplings, at least if you're at high energies, are much bigger than the 1 over M Planck. And this result is sometimes known as the Okay, so let me just make a quick aside and mention the corresponding standard model thing, just because it's a useful thing to know. Let me just move some of this stuff up. So in the standard model, you have massive vector bosons, and the massive vector bosons have transverse components from the underlying gauge dynamics, and they have a longitudinal component from the Eaton-Goldstone. And it turns out that in the standard model, in this gauge boson case, you have essentially an enhancement at high energies compared to the vector boson mass, corresponding to an effective coupling to the underlying Goldstone mode. So the way to see this is, if I look at the propagator for a massive vector boson, let's say I choose a unitary gauge. The propagator for a massive vector boson, let's say I look at the W boson, for example. If I look at the propagator for a massive vector boson, I have this longitudinal piece. And the enhancement that comes about occurs when the energy is large compared to mw squared. And for energies large compared to mw squared, this p squared over mw squared is going to beat out this piece. And an explicit example of this happening is the decay of the top quark. So recall that a top quark almost always decays into a bottom quark and a w. And the top quark is at least somewhat heavier than the W mass. It's slightly more than twice as heavy. But let's take the limit where the top quark mass is actually a fair bit heavier than that. So we look at the limit where the W mass is really small compared to the top mass. In this case, the characteristic momentum in the process is given by M top. And if I was to apply naive dimensional analysis to this, what I would get for the decay rate would be, I'd have a gauge coupling. So I'd have something that would look like gauge coupling squared over 4 pi times m top. So this is just naive dimensional analysis. But it turns out that you actually do a little bit better than this. And you do a little bit better than, or I shouldn't say better than this, the actual answer is slightly different from this parametrically, because I haven't included some of the physics. And the physics I haven't included is this polarization. So the amplitude for this would look something like minus I u bar 2 gamma mu pl u 1. So this is momentum 2, momentum 1, momentum 3. And then I would contract this up with an epsilon mu of p3. So here I have my p1, p2, p3. So this is just a usual amplitude. This is the B quark spinner. This is the top quark spinner. This is the W boson coupling, and this is the W boson polarization. Okay, maybe there's this. And what I want to get for the matrix element to get the total decay rate is the so-called, which is the sum over spins and the sum over polarizations of this quantity. So again, I do my usual thing. Here's my matrix element. I square it. And at this point, things depend on the polarization of my W and the spins of my bottom and top quarks. But I sum over them. And when I sum over them, what I'm going to get is something that looks like, so again, I'm just doing this very quickly, but I'm going to get something that looks like trace p slash 2 plus mb gamma mu pl p slash 1 plus mt gamma nu pl. And then from the polarization part, I'm going to get something that looks like minus p3 mu p3 nu. I'm forgetting my polarization sums. Minus eta mu nu plus p3 mu p3 nu over mw squared. So the spin sum gives me this. The polarization sum is going to give me this. And the point is that in the limit where the top quark is much heavier than the W mass, this piece gets an enhancement. And if you take this, you work it out, and then plug it into the expression for the decay rate, what you actually get is that this decay rate goes like, I still get my g squared over 4 pi for the couplings, but I get an mt over mw squared enhancement relative to what I have naively from dimensional analysis. And the place where I get this enhancement is precisely from the fact that this thing in the squared is going to go roughly like mt squared over mw squared. So this is the so-called longitudinal enhancement. And a suggestive way to write this is recall that mt over mw is roughly the top quark Yukawa divided by top quark Yukawa times v squared over the W gauge coupling, g times the VEV squared. So this thing goes roughly like y top squared over 4 pi times m top. And the way to interpret this, one interpretation of this, is that it's a longitudinal piece of the polarization sum that's dominating here. And instead of computing with the W, I could have used instead an effective coupling of the form B bar gamma mu PLT. And instead of coupling to the W, I could have thought about this as an effective operator involving a derivative of the, I'll write it as a derivative of phi and the effects of strength of this would be the top Yukawa. So this is, if you like, an explicit example of the so-called Goldstone boson equivalence principle, where at high energies, it's typically the longitudinal mode that dominates in interactions with massive vector bosons. And instead of computing with a massive vector boson, as we've done here, I could have gotten the same result by just computing with this effect of Goldstone boson coupling. So this is a big aside, but this is just a standard model thing. There's a nice discussion of it in, I think, chapter 20 or 21 of Peskin Schroeder. But in any case, what's happening for the Goldstone here, or I should say the Goldstino and the Gravitino, is now the Gravitino is like our massive vector boson. And in the limit where the energy of the process is very large compared to the mass of the Goldstone, the mass of the Gravitino, it's the Goldstone mode that dominates. I goofed this up slightly. I shouldn't have written it like this. I think the correct coupling is something like B bar T just directly to the Goldstone boson. And this is the coupling that you would have to the Goldstone boson from the Yukawa coupling. There's some story with derivatives that I'm forgetting. But in any case, this is this is the standard model equivalent. I've kind of done this on the fly, so you're better off reading up on how it's done properly, but roughly, you can see this in the decay of the top to WB, and the same thing happens for gravitino decays. And we're going to apply this enhancement in a second. I've got a few more minutes, so I'll say a few things and then finish up. So where are we? Okay, so the last few things I wanted to say before moving on to the next topic, and I think I'll have to finish up the rest tomorrow, but it's just to say a few words about the observational consequences of supersymmetry, and specifically the MSSM. So the first thing I want to talk about for the signal is dark matter and the LSP. So LSP is just light as superpartner. And because we're assuming they have R parity, it's absolutely stable. And a stable new particle is just the thing we want for dark matter. Now, beyond just being stable, cosmology suggests that any new stable particles should be neutral under electromagnetism or SU3 color. So there's a cosmological limit already because we have a stable new state. This state should be neutral, or EM neutral and color neutral. If you have a new stable state that's not discharged under SU3 color or electromagnetism, it would interact too much, and we would have seen it already on a fairly general grounds. So this means that as far as LSP goes, we have three potential candidates within the MSSM. So we can either have the lightest neutralino, chi01. You can have the lightest sneutrino, or you can have the gravitino. So the case that people look at most of all is the lightest neutralino. So remember, this is a mixture of the neutral Higgsinos and the neutral Gaginos after electric symmetry breaking. And this state, it turns out, can give you a very nice dark matter candidate. It can actually produce the right dark matter relic density through the thermal freezeout in a fairly straightforward way. And this, by far, is the case that's been studied the most. Of a neutralino LSP. So we have four neutralinos, and remember that we label them in order of increasing mass. So chi01 is the lightest neutralino, and here we're assuming it's the lightest superpartner. In principle, we could also have a sneutrino LSP, but it turns out that the standard model sneutrinos have relatively large effective weak couplings to standard model states. So they have large weak couplings, at least relative to the neutralinos, and it turns out that the weak couplings of the sneutrinos are typically so large that we would have seen them already if we had a sneutrino LSP. So the sneutrino LSP, at least in the MSSM, doesn't work very well. It can work if you mix in new singlet sneutrinos, but let's not worry too much about it. So the sneutrino case doesn't get too much attention. And finally, you could also have a gravitino LSP. So having a gravitino LSP depends on the mechanism of supersymmetry breaking. So it could occur, for example, in gravity mediation, maybe, maybe not. It's almost certainly the case in gauge mediation, and it's essentially never the case in anomaly mediation. So anomaly mediation gives you a neutralino LSP. Gravity mediation gives you either neutralino or the superpartner LSP, or possibly the gravitino. It depends on the details. And finally, gauge mediation essentially always gives you a gravitino LSP. So the gravitino LSP case. Is looked at mostly within gauge mediation. And what happens here, I'll just finish it up in a second. What happens here is that we also have a lightest MSSM superpartner in the sense that we call the NLSP the lightest standard model superpartner. And what I mean by this is the lightest standard model superpartner is all the stuff in the MSSM aside from the Gravitino. And this NLSP state, let's say I call it X tilde, will decay to its standard model state plus the Gravitino. And the decay rate for this goes roughly like mx to the fifth, m3/2 squared, and Planck squared. And based on this, we see that if you take the limit where this superpartner mass is much larger than m3/2, then in m3/2, I can do a cancellation between this and m Planck squared. And in this limit, I can also rewrite this as mx tilde to the fifth over f squared. And this 1 over f squared instead of a 1 over m Planck squared comes about precisely because of this Goldstein equivalence principle. So this decay, it turns out, can be interesting for cosmology. It can also be interesting for collider stuff. I'm out of time, so I'll finish there. But my plan for tomorrow is to just do a quick wrap-up of supersymmetry and then move on to our next model, or our next paradigm of new physics, which is new strong forces, and specifically new strong forces that generate electric symmetry breaking. So before I wrap up, any questions? Yes.
A could we use the spontaneous symmetry breaking of supersymmetry get some spontaneous Poincaré breaking or something? Because, you know, there are people who consider gravity theories with massive graviton. And could something be, could that be related to supersymmetry breaking somehow?
I suppose it could in principle. I think the challenge, though, is that you're not allowed to, so you want to break supersymmetry by quite a lot, just to give you this observation, but you also want to, if you're going to break Poincaré, you also want to break that by only a tiny, tiny amount. So you would need this big separation of kind of big supersymmetry breaking a very small Poincaré. And at least based on having such a large separation of scales, I would be inclined to treat that breaking in two stages. Where first you have a supersymmetry breaking stage, and then you integrate out that dynamics, and then treat the Poincaré breaking as some much lower energy thing in effective theory. But I mean, having said that, it's not something I've thought about. So maybe you could all do it all in one fell swoop. Or at least my initial inclination would be to separate it in this kind of EFT mode. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.